Friday, April 3rd. Mr. James Fosberg arrived at 10 o'clock this morning, and we had nearly 2 hours of art talk about what would be nice to go with the child Hassam and the Mary Cassatt in our own West Hall living area, about where to hang the Durand of the Hudson River School when it has finished being cleaned up. Mr. Fosberg's advice to bring the gift from Mrs. Marshall Field of the painting of the Battle of Lake Erie from the fish room to some more eminent spot in the White House itself, and we think perhaps the East Hall above the sofa. And most important of all, the possibility of where we might hang the Winslow Homer watercolor, which has the fantastic price tag that I don't know whether we can ever afford. It still comes behind in order of importance, paying for the drapes in the East Room, which we are already obligated for since they were selected by Mrs. Kennedy about last September and already ordered woven in France. And then we'll look forward to whatever else we might acquire. He's really so terribly nice, and I do like him. After he left, I had a bite of lunch with Linda and Warren Lynn, and then went out to the Elms for a long and tedious 3 hours of work in the basement. But mainly today will be remembered for happy reasons, because this morning, for the first time in such a long time, Lynn sounded bouncy and like himself, and there were no night sweats. And later on in the day, I heard that Mac George Bundy had used the expression, coming into his office, "Mr. President, peace is breaking out all over." This will be remembered by me as the day that we resumed diplomatic relations with Panama. Lyndon spoke in the crowded cabinet room about the agreement to restore diplomatic relations and about sending former Treasury Secretary Robert Anderson to discuss the canal treaty issue. He had called up Bob, put out his request with all the urgency of which he is so beautifully capable, and I know he had hung breathless on his answer, though it must have been with a great feeling of achievement, of relief, that he heard Bob say, "Yes, Mr. President, I'll go if you want me to." Lyndon won his point of keeping our discussions with Panama without limitations or preconditions of any kind, and also the selection of Bob Anderson, a Texas Democrat turned Republican during the Eisenhower era, took out some insurance by giving a bipartisan tinge to whatever will now emerge. And then, for the distaff side of the house, came the big event of the day, a 5 o'clock reception for about 150 guests. Actually, it began when Lyndon made a televised speech in the East Room to the assembled guests, all the ambassadors from the 15 NATO countries and their wives, Matsis of Greece, Menemenciaglu of Turkey, British Ambassador and Lady Harlech, Sergio Finiolteos from Italy, Countess Knuth Winterfeldt of Denmark, there without her husband, and Monsieur Alphand of France, there without the beautiful Madame Alphand, and all the rest, including a good many chargés d'affaires. I was on the front row with Dean Rusk and Mrs. Rusk, the George Balls and the Alexis Johnsons were handy. And oh, happy thought, the Dean Achesons were there. Some of the congressional leaders, including Bill and Betty Fulbright and Lindy Boggs, were there. And the columnists who deal especially in foreign affairs, such as the Walter Lippmanns and the Scotty Restons, as well as a brace of military. General Omar Bradley on crutches, but all smiles and the center of much happy gathering. Handsome blonde Loris Norstad, former head of NATO, and Mrs. Norstad. I was real pleased with Lyndon's speech, which was not only good words, but good delivery, especially liking a line he used from the late French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman, I believe it was 1949, when he said for France that modern nations no longer can base their salvation and welfare upon an egotistical and aggressive nationalism.
Small arrow
flown in the general direction of De Gaulle.
Another good phrase.
Another good phrase was, "We have our hand out, but our guard up." And he spoke with hope of the new spirit of diversity in communist Eastern Europe. All in all, the speech recognized that the world had changed a lot in the 15 years of NATO's life. But he called NATO the recognized foundation stone of U.S. foreign policy. When the speech finished, I moved swiftly to the door of the state dining room and thereby missed the single most poignant moment of the evening, because Lyndon asked former Secretary of State Dean Acheson to come up and talk to them, introducing him as the man most responsible for NATO. Later that I heard that Dean Acheson, never without words, found himself suddenly hard put to express himself. Then everybody filed by into the state dining room, shaking hands and on in for drinks and hors d'oeuvres, and a general air of revelry prevailed. The heady feel of victory is rare enough in this business, so let's savor it when it happens, and that's how this evening felt to me. I stayed rather a long time, enjoying talking with lots of people I knew, the Matsis, the Turkish ambassador, and Madame Miminin Siaglu, General Omar Bradley, whom I, along with everybody else, admire so much, and Mrs. Dean Acheson. But finally, when I began to wonder whether people with dinner engagements were looking eagerly over their shoulders, saying, "Have they gone yet?" so that they could leave, I slipped out and went up in the elevator, having heard in one ear that Lyndon had invited a few people to join us later for dinner, the Max Friedmans, the Bill Whites, the Mac George Bundys, and of course Jack Valenti. It was really a triumph on the part of Lyndon's staff to have accumulated so many people important to NATO on such short notice. I think the inviting had gone on until 10 or 11 o'clock the night before, by telephone or telegram. Admiral Radford and Mrs. Radford and the Ridgeways were among those there. Pretty soon our dinner guest joined us, and Bill White told me he had put proof sheets of his book into Lyndon's hand that day, so I knew we'd have some late reading hours coming up. I had a chance to thank Max Friedman for some of the rolling spiritual words he had put together as the foundation of my talk when I go to the luncheon for the Eleanor Roosevelt Foundation. The conversation got around to the beginning of NATO and Vandenberg's part in it, and I believe it was Mac Bundy who said, quoting Vandenberg, that the greatest merit of NATO is that it is inside the charter but outside the veto. We talked about the press and the part it plays in Washington, and either Max or Bill said, "The press is one of the great parts of the government, and the White House that cuts itself off from the press cuts itself off from a large part of government." I could not choose six or eight people I'd rather spend time with more than these. And such evenings are the rich sustenance of Washington that I shall miss when I'm sitting in that rocking chair just watching the Pernellis roll by. They left early, and it was a reasonable hour to bed, and one of my last grateful thoughts was that Linda and Lucy had been present, pretty, cordial, useful, and apparently regarding it as much as an opportunity as an obligation. Linda, at least, on being asked by Candace Knuth Winterfeld to a dance that her daughter was giving that night, had said, "All right, I think I just can," and had gotten herself a White House aide, and out she had put. And I hope it was a good evening for her.